This is tape number 8, the morning of January the 8th, 1961.
Shall we go on with Woodrow Wilson in his first term again and see what you have to comment about his adventure into Mexico, let's say?
Well, the situation developed in the southwest part of the United States when they... what is the name of that Mexican...
Pancho Villa?
Pancho Villa came over into Columbus caused the trouble that he did. And at that time, we were not on very friendly terms with the Mexican government. Huerta, I think, was the president. As a result of the assassination of the duly elected president of Mexico. And
Madero, wasn't it?
Madero, yeah. Madero was the duly elected president. He was assassinated. And then Huerta grabbed power by military means and not by election. And Wilson, of course, didn't approve of that. And when Villa came into across the border into the United States, then Wilson thought that something ought to be done. And when they tore up the American flag in Veracruz, he caused that landing down there for a return of respect to the American flag. Well, now, the Mexican people have finally found that our attitude toward them is most friendly, and there has not been one bit of trouble since the situation developed by Villa and Huerta have been overcome. And Mexico, since that time, has had 5 or 6 duly elected presidents and has followed through its program of government on the basis of chief executive and a legislative and a judicial program that's as fine a government as he is in the Western Hemisphere, including our own.
You don't think that the Wilson's intervention in Mexico was an act of aggression or hostility?
Not at all. Not at all. He had no territorial ambitions. He was trying to keep the peace on the border and to prevent a dictator from going outside his prerogative as president of Mexico, and finally succeeded. And the successors of that regime have been all friendly to us and all the finest kind of men. The presidents of Mexico have been statesmen. And I know from experience, because I've been acquainted with nearly every one of them that's been in there since that time.
And you say that this was a constructive action in this, it helped to stabilize the government of Mexico
from there on? I think it did. And I think that was the intention. I don't think there was any intention of infringing on the prerogatives and powers of the Republic of Mexico when those things were done. There was a turmoil going on in Mexico at the time, which has long been settled. And they now have a peaceful approach to elections and everything else that takes place in that great country.
Wilson, more or less, was known and enunciated many doctrines, personal doctrines of peace. Wasn't this a little contrary to Wilson's character to undertake it?
I don't think so. He was trying to get peace in the Western Hemisphere and finally succeeded in doing it.
This also resulted in General Pershing becoming
Commanding General of the First World War, under whom I served.
Was there any involvement there with Teddy Roosevelt at that time, or with?
No, Teddy was very anxious to command a division in France, and Wilson would not agree to it because he thought it was a political maneuver, and it in all probability was. But it was a good thing that didn't happen, for before that war was over, Teddy died, and I think he could have made a good division commander, but it would have been a political proposition all the way through. And Wilson didn't have any political generals. The generals were made in command of the divisions and all the rest of the setup in the First World War on the basis of efficiency and their military education.
Leonard Wood was another one that kept...
Same way, exactly. He was a political general, just the same as Teddy would have been.
Now, the problem of keeping in touch with the public during the Wilson administration was a lot more difficult than it would be now. He held no press conferences.
Well, not ordinarily he didn't, but I think he started the press conference idea off on one or two occasions, and then it was followed through by successors after Roosevelt became president.
May I suggest that press conference doesn't necessarily keep the president in touch with the public. He's in touch with the public by the acts and speeches and statements he issues outside of the press conference. Press conference, it seems to me, in the last few years, is being exaggerated into a very important instrument. It is an important instrument, but not that important, because all the acts of the president are important, and he doesn't have to do that through a press conference.
Well, the president uses the press for another reason.
Well, wait a minute. Am I right about that, Mr.
Yes, you are. You're right about it in this way, that the president's appearance before the country is in the messages and speeches which he makes on policy. But the press conference is a useful adjunct for the president to keep in touch with what's going on in the country. I like the press conference and have a great time with the press people, and I usually found out more from them than they did from me, for the simple reason that I knew exactly what their bosses were after and what they were trying to do. And it helped me very much in pursuing the policies on which I was trying to carry out for the benefit and welfare of the country. And I think press conference is all right. I still like them. I have them all the time.
Yes, I'm not deprecating them. On the contrary, what I'm finding out is that whatever action the president takes, he doesn't have to take it through a press conference. Whatever action he takes is therefore being in contact with the people.
Fundamental, basic things are never taken through a press conference. They're taken through a policy program, either a message to Congress or in some speech that he makes in a certain part of the country that has to do with a policy that he wants to pursue. Press conference is usually for the purpose of asking questions on what's already been done, and then finding out what the possibility is of something else being done in the same line. But policy is never inaugurated in press conference.
That's what I wanted to bring up.
That's right. Correct.
Well, but then, in a sense, a president can control pretty much what he wants to say to the country direct on a kind of a president of the people basis.
That's right. He has the access to all four of the television and to all of the television and radio programs, and then he releases statements to the press through his press secretary, and his communication with the country is not confined to a press conference. A press conference is a kind of a show, and one of the best there is in Washington.
Now, Wilson didn't resort to that too often.
No, I think he really started, though, in one or two instances. He had what purported to be a press conference, but the press conference was not didn't reach its zenith until Franklin Roosevelt became president. He made great use of it.
Now, because he couldn't get around. Now, president does get around and does make speeches on certain important occasions, uses those as a platform to enunciate certain
That's right, points. And he always has a press conference in every town, wherever he goes. I still do it.
Now, did Wilson travel very much, or did he stay pretty
yes,
much
in the Yes, he did. He did a great deal of traveling, but his great program of travel was when he was trying to put over the League of Nations on his tour around the country.
That we leave
and
with
that's where he had this stroke that put him out of business.
But the difficulty in making clear what's in a president's mind still is there if the press doesn't want to help along.
Oh, yes, but then the president can always get around the press. He can go to some meetings in two or three key cities and make the press like what he wants to say if he wants to do it. But most of the working press are always friendly to the occupant of the White House, and they want to give him the best break possible, and they usually do. I never had any trouble with them.
At any rate, most of the newspapers, all of the newspapers, in fact, will publish any official statement of the president.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Well, but it's clear through reading of all the back history that the press, particularly the press of the North, had an inordinate position in fanning and arousing and needling the populations into furies and all kinds of passions. But the press was active and was a thorn in the side of Abe Lincoln as a case in point.
That's right. What you're talking about, Dave, I think the president really is talking about is their attempts through their news columns and their editorial pages to editorialize about a situation.
Very much well, so indeed, yes.
Well yes, but I don't think that Lincoln paid a great deal of attention to it. I ran across one of his statements one time about a vicious editorial that had been written about him, I think by James Gordon Bennett, and somebody asked him about it, one of the other newspaper people, and he said, oh, well, if I spent my time fooling with things of that kind and trying to reply to every lie that's told on me, I wouldn't have a chance to run the government.
That's right.
Remember
that's
that,
right.
That statement is not exactly like that, but it's somewhere in his relations with the press.
Now, what was, to summarize Wilson in his first term, what was unique and paralleled as between him and any other president up to his time?
Well, he was a man who believed that the people ought to be kept informed on what the president wanted to do. And he arrived at that conclusion, I'm sure, in his great history of the American people. And he tried his best to keep the people and the public informed on what his program was intended to be. And had not the First World War got us involved, I think he would have succeeded in getting that done. Of course, when the war came along, he had to change his policy. And he couldn't say everything that was on his mind until he came to that great speech on the 18 points, which finally caused the surrender of Germany.
14 points.
I mean the 14 points. 14 points. I said 18. 14 points.
Yes, and you say that his ability to explain and express the policies and the views that he held in his administration were very, very important and unprecedented in the
Yes, they were vital, and they were unprecedented. And he reestablished the precedent of the president going down delivering his messages in person to the Congress. That hadn't been done. I don't think it had been done since Jefferson's time.
What were his relations with his cabinet?
Not very cordial. He had quite a cabinet, and the main difficulty with his ability to get along with his cabinet, he hated to delegate responsibility. He didn't like to delegate responsibility. And his cabinet was almost purely political. And Wilson had an idea that he was the smartest man in the United States, and he was at that time. And, of course, people who were associated with him didn't like that attitude.
Did he hold regular cabinet meetings?
Yes, of course. All presidents have.
And did they in any way function as important advisors to the president?
Oh, yes, I think they did. I think he had a great many men in his cabinet. He had a tremendous number of men in his cabinets. I think he was always willing to listen to them and then make up his own mind. Sometimes they didn't agree with what he'd done, and sometimes he didn't agree with what they were advising him.
You mean he had a lot of turnover in his cabinet?
Yes, he had a great many men in his cabinet. We'll have to see what the number is.
This is tape number 8, the morning of January the 8th, 1961. Off. This is tape number 1 of the 27th of January, 1961. The afternoon, the president, now is Hillman present. We were going to start in, Mr. President, to deal primarily today with the attempt to get down the introductory chapter or chapters to indicate what is it that America is? What is its part in history? Why is America? And the question I asked, as David asked, isn't the United States, isn't America an extension of European civilization with its vast history, its culture, its different races, and as you put it a little while ago, its different viewpoints?
Well, yes, I think that's true, and I don't like to think of the United States as America. It isn't. You see, there's a continent to the south of us that's four times as great as the area of the United States itself, but the settlement of the eastern coast of what later became the United States was brought about by all of the peoples of Europe, of the European civilization at that time. There were English and Scotch and French and Irish and Dutch and Swedes and French down in South Carolina. And when they were finally settled, most of them had been persecuted at home. And when they finally were settled, you see, the Catholics were in Maryland and had been persecuted in Britain. And the reason that they, I think, came out with a government that is on a basis of freedom of religion, freedom of politics, and freedom of action for the individual was brought about by the fact that every single one of the settlements were made due to persecution at home, in my opinion.
Well, why were they coming here instead of other places they could have gone to?
It was the only outlet they had.
Could have gone to Africa?
No, I don't think they could, Dave. I don't want to argue with you, but there wasn't any place in Africa where they could have gone, because the Moors had the whole northern coast of Africa, which was the entrance from Europe. And the French right now are having the same trouble with the Moors that any other organization that tried to go in there had. Their only outlet and free approach was the new continents in the Western Hemisphere, where there was no opposition on the continent except a token opposition by the inhabitants of the continent.
Well, the origin then, the founding of the colonization of the United States followed the accident of the discovery of the United States.
That's right. It followed the accident of the discovery of the Western Hemisphere, which then was open and free, and it was so great, no one at that time realized how great it was. They all, to begin with, thought they were going to India, which they were not at all.
The question I would like to ask is this. You don't believe that you can start American history or the history of the United States of America by merely indicating the dates of the discoveries and indicating the peoples that came here. Don't you think it would be helpful to indicate what European civilization was at the precise time when this explosion here to the west began?
I think it would. I think it would be an excellent idea for that European, so-called European civilization, was brought about after the Dark Ages, after the downfall of the Roman Empire, and its the fact that it had been torn apart by the Vandals and the Goths and Attila and all the rest of those savages, and that's what they were, and the Germans in across the Rhine, eventually began to settle down. And it came about that there were great nations as a result of that, but they're on a small scale, no matter how much you may think about it, but Spain and France and Britain and Northern Europe were on a very small scale as compared with the Pax Romana, that is, the Roman peace in the Mediterranean. And when that empire was entirely broken up and formed the Eastern Empire, and it was finally broken up by the Turks, boy, then the western coast of Europe was made up at the time of the settlement of this country of Spain and France and Italy and Britain. And when they discovered eventually what Columbus had opened up, then each one of them was anxious to have a hand in the control and settlement of that part of the country. But most of the settlements on the East Coast were from people who were persecuted at home and who wanted to find freedom on the American continent. And most of them found it to a certain extent. But when the organization of the colonies came about, after the French and Indian War, their idea was to set up a government that would work for the freedom of the individual, and that's the reason for the Constitution of the United States.
Just one more question in connection with that. One of the historic dates that strikes me in the history of Europe, just before the discoveries is the Protestant Revolution, because up to that time, the Christianity, which had taken over where Rome had left over, was more or less united.
That's true, and I just read an article there to go on the policy of the Roman Church, and the statement was made on behalf of the Roman Church that if they had been more tolerant and cordial toward Martin Luther, there wouldn't have been any Reformation. But the real Reformation took place during the period when Richelieu was the Prime Minister of France, and when Gustavus Adolphus was the King of Sweden. And that caused the war in which Gustavus Adolphus was killed. And it is said that in order to maintain the position of France against the Holy Roman Empire, which was Spain, the cardinal contributed to the army of Gustavus Adolphus, and that carried on the Reformation so far as Northern Europe is concerned. Now, the Scandinavians and the Germans became Lutherans, and the French, under Richelieu, finally became separated from the Catholic Church through the efforts of Lord Coligny and the Admiral Coligny and the Huguenots, some of whom, after the Edict of Nantes, immigrated to South Carolina. And you'll find that that's one of the principal reasons for the proper settlement of the whole east coast of the United States, to some extent persecution, to some extent that an idea on the part of the four great powers, Spain and France and Holland and Britain, to have a hand in the opening up of the Western Hemisphere.
Well, now, just to probe a little deeper, what were they seeking outside of escape from persecution? Were they at a point where they were trying to enlarge their horizons and seeking additional freedom, status, equality, opportunity? What?
They were trying to improve their financial status. The principal reason was that everybody thought he'd better himself if he'd go to a continent that had not yet been explored and settled and taken over by the great powers. It finally was taken over by the great powers. Spain, France, and Britain finally controlled the whole Western Hemisphere.
But the thought quickly comes to mind that here and within the United States or the colonies, there was one kind of enterprise in government being born, yet on the same hemisphere with all the elbow room and with all the opportunities existing up and down, no other similar society had been forged. Now, what brought that about?
The conclusion I can come to is that the experience and background of those people who settled the New England and New Jersey, they're Swedes, and New York, who were Dutch, and the Maryland, who were the Catholics from England, under Lord Baltimore, and the so-called Virginia settlements, which were supposed to be the men who had been overcome by Cromwell, North and South Carolina, all those people were here for the purpose of religious freedom, those that I've named. And when they finally got to the point where they were kind of a unit in the Continental Congress, then they began to study the organization of government. I think that the Constitutional Convention was made up of men who knew more about the history of government than any constitutional outfits ever been gotten together.
But it took 150 years before this experiment, this aggregation of people matured into some kind of a homogeneous society.
From 1608 and 1620 up until 1760 before they began to get together. And that's a long time. That's on account of communication and transportation.
And owing to the fact that they were not united but had separate developments and separate growths everywhere.
Well, that's true, but it's communication and transportation that has made the United States what it is, because we now have communication system and a transportation system that's almost out of this world when you come right down to it. And in those days, it took 5 or 6 days to go from Baltimore to New York. Now you can do it in half an hour.
But that was a mechanical device, something else that must have driven them together into one coalescing society.
Well, the driving of them together, when the British came in control of the 13 colonies from Georgia to Maine, was the tax attitude of the British government. I think if you read Fox and Burke, you'll find out that they understood what was happening, and the rest of the British government did not. That's what the trouble was.
Before the tax issue arose, however, the fact that the great majority of the people on the eastern coast were brought up under a British system had a good deal of historic significance in the way
that
they worked out.
And any question about that, while all this was going on, Britain was itself emerging as a free government. And of course it all worked together, but I think the best asset the British ever had was the rebellion of the colonies, of the 13 colonies. And that created the present attitude of the British toward the people who were dependent on them.
Wasn't that more or less of a pretext? It wasn't, the oppression wasn't that extreme that it acted as the means by which these people, or as the reason for the breakaway. It was something else.
Well, they felt like their rights were being taken away from them. What they really wanted in the beginning was representation in the British Parliament, and they didn't get it. And that's what really brought the situation about, because they didn't have any representation when they were being taxed. And their slogan was, taxation without representation is tyranny. And that's on which the basis on which they worked.
And that became a piece of the liberty they were demanding.
That's right. And also became one of the features of the British Empire on its reformation and the proper approach to its colonial governments.
This is the end of tape 1, the afternoon of January the 27th.